Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, has our society created a charitable industrial complex? And if so, what are its effects? Then, the long-term effects of bullying on victims, bullies, and society itself. The nonprofit sector has grown by roughly 25%, says our next guest, and given away some $316 billion. All while inequality has grown and some 9.4 million people remain unemployed. It's part of the effects of what he calls the charitable industrial complex that may merely be perpetuating global poverty. Peter Buffett joins us. He's an Emmy Award-winning musician, composer, author of the book Life is What You Make It, and a philanthropist. He co-chairs the Novo Foundation, one of three foundations that is funded by his father, Warren Buffett. Welcome, Peter Buffett.
Thank you very much.
It's great to have you here with us on the Scholar Circle. Let's start with this idea that you wrote about in the New York Times called philanthropic colonialism. What exactly do you mean by this?
Well, I'm going to start by saying I'm completely intimidated by the name Scholar Circle, because I'm no scholar, but I'll do my best. And, you know, it's interesting in a way because that framework, the colonialist framework for me started when I was involved with the American Indian culture and learned all sorts of things historically about our country that I never learned in school. So I got sensitive to the idea of a culture coming in to another framework that they didn't know or understand or want to learn about, and essentially, in the case of America, you know, try and just completely get it out of the way. And so in a much milder form, I started to hear stories around philanthropic work, and in fact was guilty of it myself, you know, where somebody would think, oh my gosh, well, this sounds like this would be the perfect answer to that particular problem. Coming from the outside, having no real clue to the intricacies and nuances on the ground. And so I guess coined the term philanthropic colonialism. And of course, all the people on the ground jump up and down in glee when they hear a funder say that, because they know firsthand what happens when somebody, specifically, of course, with money, comes into a place to say, I'll solve your problem for you.
So what are some examples of the unintended consequences of this particular phenomenon you're talking about?
Well, you know, I cite one in the op-ed, which is interesting because it's fascinating to read the criticism around that. But, you know, there was a very well-meaning attempt to stop the spread of HIV and AIDS in part of India. I think it was Calcutta in particular in this case. And, you know, the idea was a lot of it gets spread through the brothels and through the red light districts. And that, I'm sure, is very true. So there was the idea of making sure condom use was widespread by distributing them, at least, you know, the hope that it would be used. And I'm sure there was training and all sorts of things. And the first real underlying problem that I didn't mention that does is it legitimizes brothels and red light areas. It says, okay, we're just going to make them better. And if you spend any time with girls that have been trafficked into these areas, the last thing you want to do is legitimize it. So there's that layer of it. And then the next layer is, in fact, the shifting pricing structure because of it. And the girls will get paid more if they have unprotected sex. Now, some people say, well, that must mean there's, you know, still more protected sex, and isn't that better because they're getting more money? And it's like, not really. It's a much larger problem than that. And yes, that might be a little bit of a consequence, but again, the larger point is it's legitimizing the practice and putting these girls in even a more complex situation that is not of their preference in the least. And so that's one example.
The other thing that I thought was really interesting was this kind of juxtaposition of you getting to sit in on some of these conversations that you witnessed because of your dad,
right.
And seeing the left hand creating the problem and the right hand trying to solve the problem. And you left it a little bit vague as to who was trying to solve the problem, who was creating the problem, even though I think, you know, most of us kind of have a sense of who you're talking
right,
about.
Exactly. Yeah.
But for those who don't quite understand what you meant by that, who was in the room?
And that's the thing, is that I remind everyone that the emperor has no clothes story was not about shaming the emperor. It was about saying what was obvious. And so it's true, you know, that there's this tendency to say, tell me more. The truth is, and this is the complexity of the world we live in today, is when you're in the room with any entity that is a global corporate enterprise, of which, you know, they're the ones with the most money, and therefore they are at these larger gatherings, and in fact they are sitting with heads of state. And these are well-meaning people. You know, that's the other part that's often left out, and it was actually in the op-ed at one point and got edited out, that these are well-meaning people. This is, no one's doing this on purpose, but you've got, you know, shareholder value and quarterly returns and the drive to do things most efficiently as you can for all those reasons happening on the one hand. And so that means that you might be degrading the environment, you might be offering lower wages, and so there's poverty and hunger and all the things that go with that. There's a host of issues that accompany any corporation that is publicly held that is trying to serve its shareholders the best it can, while on the other hand, it is creating often, you know, not always, issues on the other side of the globe around wages and environmental issues and health issues and all sorts of things. And so then when the foundation side of this particular company, or a foundation that has its corpus invested in these companies, you know, that's another whole layer to this, is that it might be a foundation head, very well-meaning, doing the best they can. Meanwhile, they're making money to do good by investing the very dollars in a corporation that is undermining them in the very work they're trying to help solve or make better. So there's these various layers where the one hand, in fact, is creating the issue that the other hand is trying to solve or make better in some way.
And never mind that all of our pensions are connected as well into these very problem-making systems.
Well, that's the thing, is it's so inextricably linked. I mean, you can look at the simple version, and again, I am not a scholar, so I'm sure every example I cite, someone, that's what I've noticed with the op-ed, is that people can get in there and go, well, what about this? But the truth is, you know, people are clamoring for jobs, understandably, and at the same time insisting at their local Target or Walmart or whatever it might be for lowest prices. Well, those are inextricably linked, and you're going to end up with jobs going overseas and creating other problems because of that to get the lower prices, which then put people out of jobs. I mean, it just keeps going around and around.
And you noted in your op-ed piece that while inequality is rising, the nonprofit sector is growing.
Correct. And people have pointed out that again, no more than I do, that in fact it stayed about 2% of GDP since the 70s. But it still is true that there's more and more affinity groups and gatherings, and it's definitely talked about a lot more and practiced, I think, quite a bit more by high-profile people than it was in the 70s, for sure. I mean, there's a whole different kind of lens on philanthropy today than there ever was 20 or 30 years ago or more.
You've said that in a way, this is another phrase that you coined, conscience laundering, that
right.
keeps this system in place and it just perpetuates the injustice.
I think it really does, because again, I think people thought, and rightly so, if you just look on the surface of the piece, that I was indicting, you know, philanthropy as this awful thing. And what I'm really saying is, again, first of all, they're very much well-meaning people, and that it is part of a systemic problem. You know, it somehow doesn't get a pass because it's doing good things. I'm not saying it's the problem. I'm saying that there's a lot of symptoms, actually, that show up because systemically, there's something I think deeply flawed in what's going on right now.
How many of those kind of meetings did it actually take for this to dawn on you?
Oh, that's a great question, because we have been working in the philanthropic world at the scale we have for the last 7 years. And for instance, the philanthropic colonialism verbiage, came out early on, like within the first year or so, I started saying that. And then you start piecing the puzzle together by going places, experiencing things, obviously, talking to more people. And, you know, we don't really go to too many every year. And there's plenty of value, by the way, in going to some of these. I mean, I went to the first Clinton Global Initiative in 2005 and learned a ton. And it was life-changing in some ways in terms of our focus. So there's value as well as, you know, the starting to observe the complexity of the whole thing. But it was over the 7 years, and then finally it all kind of clicked this year.
I think you titled the piece The Charitable Industrial Complex.
Right, exactly, because it's just, and it's funny because somebody was criticizing me about, well, not technically because of this or that, and it's like, that's not the point.
Exactly, yeah.
With 800 words, you can only go so far.
Some of the means some of these charities are approaching, what they think will create sustainable economies, like microlending, financial literacy, might just be what you said, feeding the beast. Do you think that it is?
I think it can be. I think that some of the microlending practices and the idea that let's just get people into our economy is very destructive. I mean, it's interesting how a lot of people will say, and this makes a lot of sense on the surface, we got to get people living on more than $2 a day. Well, who wouldn't agree with that? Except I would actually flip that on its head and say we should all get closer to living on $2 a day. And that's, of course, extreme. But the idea is that it's not about, you know, pulling people into this economy that sort of, again, is sort of, you know, the snake eating its tail or something. We should think about how do we all get back to, really, because it's all very old thinking, a more community-based, decentralized relationship economy that is fundamentally very different than what we're looking at today. I mean, I do not understand why anybody needs tens of millions, hundreds of millions, billions of dollars in multiple houses and boats and all this crazy stuff, while on the other side of the street or the planet, there are people that, you know, we now actually see. You know, when I was a kid, it was, you know, finish your dinner, there's someone starving in India or something. Well, now, you know what, we see these people, and they're real, and they have stories, and, you know, this is no longer something we can sort of put under the rug.
Your dad, who is one of the most successful, if not the most successful investor, who has made
billions of dollars.
Exactly.
Yes, exactly.
Have you talked with him about this? What is his response?
Well, in terms of the piece itself, he loved it because we come from a family that, you know, I was a kid during the 60s in the civil rights movement, and my parents were both active and involved and deeply caring people. And in fact, my dad knew then, when he was much younger and didn't have the kind of money he had, that he had a particular talent that would probably make him a lot of money. That was an understatement, but that's what he certainly knew that early on, and knew that it should just go right back into the world that helped him do what he loved every day. You know, because for him, it's not, gee, look at all this money, now I can buy all this stuff. It's like, wow, I love going to the office 6 days a week, doing what I do. All this money seems to be piling up. I want to give it away when I'm done to the society that gave me this great gift of doing what I love.
And he has been doing that. As you
yeah.
said, he set up these foundations and he's donating his money in very large chunks back to society. And he pays his staff very well.
Yeah, no, he's a fair guy, you know, and he's going to, and again, you know, the people that say, well, he just doesn't want to pay taxes, you know, even if he had to pay whatever rate on it, he'd still do the same thing. It's the gesture, again, of saying, look, I am so fortunate that I was able to do what I love every day. this society allowed that, this society gets the money back. It's pretty simple.
Let's move to your own foundation and link it into one of the directions that you were trying to go in with your op-ed piece. You said, I don't know that I'm really calling for an end to capitalism itself. I'm calling for humanism. But given the structures, these things that you've noticed and I've noticed as a political scientist of modern day capitalism, how can humanism be infused when it's part of the legal structure itself?
Well, that's a great question. And in fact, I will tell you the truth. I didn't want to get into the economic structure debate within the op-ed because, you know, I knew that there could be one, and I think there should be one. But I wanted to, again, bring it around to let's go from transactions to relationships. You know, we have lost that over the past 40, 50 years, 100 years. You know, this is, all of this stuff is new, which I want to remind everybody. You know, the problems may be relatively old in some ways, but nation states are only a couple hundred years old. I mean, this is all new stuff. And so we're learning as we go. And instead of drawing fire, you know, by saying specifically this is a flawed structure, I'd rather say this is a systemic problem. Let's look at various pieces to the puzzle and find an answer that results in, again, relationships, humanism, you know, putting the person first before the best return on investment, essentially.
A quick reminder that you're listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're speaking with Peter Buffett about what he calls the charitable industrial complex and conscience laundering. Let's move then to the Novo Foundation that you are co-chair of and what it is that you're trying to do with that. I looked at your mission statement. It's quite profound, really, to foster transformation from a world of domination and exploitation to one of collaboration and partnership.
Well, yeah.
It's a big vision.
If you're going to do it, you might as well go for it as far as we're concerned. And Jennifer and I both, Jennifer's my wife, Jennifer and I both really thought, you know, and again, this comes from the work in the American Indian culture. It comes from other things we've seen and done in our lives that ultimately we got to get back to knowing our neighbor, knowing ourselves, knowing our community. How do we do that? Because what I've found is that, you know, if you look somebody in the eye, you start to have a different feeling about things than if, again, they're under the rug or non-existent. And if you knew who your banker was, if you knew who your farmer was, if you knew where these things came from and had relationships, which, again, has been going on for thousands of years, I think we'd have a different world today, basically. I think we'd have something where there hopefully was no need for charity, frankly, that the root word of philanthropy, which is the love of people, is really what we're going for. So we figured, why not hang that out on our shingle?
And let's talk about some of the ways that you're doing that. One is you've got a focus on women and girls in particular. First of all, what drew you to focus on women and girls, and what are you doing to support their development and potential?
Well, a couple of reasons. One, only a girl will be the mother of every child. No one's argued with me on that point yet. And so, in fact, when you do support a girl in terms of health and education and all these, you know, possible ways she can live into her best self, you're going to support a whole next generation, boys or girls, because it really isn't ultimately about one gender or the other. It's about everybody. But a girl is a faster way to get there. It's a more efficient way to get there. I mean, now I will get all the return on investment people, you know, mad at me, because in that sense, it is a good return on investment. If you're going to support a girl, you know, you look in the aid world, the development world, and where the dollars are deployed. When they are, and they rarely are, deployed to a young girl or, you know, a young woman, it will stay in the family, in the community. It just has a different outcome generally than it does if you give it to an institution or to a man, frankly. I mean, it's pretty simple in that regard. And so you add the efficiency with the fact that she's going to be the mom and it's going to stay in the community, and you get a better result.
And you also said that there are people showing examples of these other ways to live, these other kinds of communities that truly create greater prosperity for all. What are some examples?
Well, that's where we're trying to seed, and that's a key word or concept, really. We're only trying to create conditions for change. We're not sure how change is going to come, and we're not going to try and define what it looks like, but we are going to try and create conditions. So we work with various projects around local living economies, which is also on the website, and ways to, again, foster a shift back to, you know, kind of this decentralized, more relationship literal economy in terms of people that are working on different frameworks around the money system. And again, this is mostly old stuff, just renewed in terms of how communities can be more resilient. And of course, the collapse in 2008 helped us. That was in our favor, sadly, you know, but in a good way. It made everybody look at their neighbor and go, uh-oh, maybe this is where I should focus, because my money in a bank that doesn't know me, or, you know, my food from a farm that I'll never see, or, you know, these various components to my life that are the lifeblood, really, of my daily existence, I don't even know who these people are or where they are, and they certainly don't know me.
You've mostly spent your life being a musician and a songwriter, and now you're also an author, and you're on tour. You're doing a music and conversation tour.
Right.
And your message in the title of your book, Life is What You Make It, which is great, but I wonder, from the title, I was wondering if maybe it masks the structural and systemic realities that you're criticizing.
Well, it's interesting because, of course, the first sentence after someone sees life is what you make it and sees my last name is easy for you to say. And that's the thing I dispel right away, whether it's live in my show or in the book or anything else, because what I'm really trying to do is reframe or rediscover the real meaning of words. And the first one is probably privilege or wealth or success or, you know, one of those. And I then go into telling my story, which is I grew up in Omaha and I walked to public school and I had the same English teacher my mother had, and, you know, all these things where privilege was growing up in a neighborhood where people knew you and loved you and nurtured you and made you feel safe. So it's really trying to get back to that as what makes us whole, as opposed to the mythology around certainly who my dad is and then who I must be, where it's all about the money and isn't it great to be rich? You know, I joke about the fact that I only recently became Warren Buffett's son. Nobody really cared, frankly, or knew, and that's great. You know, that allowed me to live my life and, you know, without my dad's help in terms of financial stability or something, you know, I talk about how self-respect comes from earning your own reward. You know, if I had a dad that wrote me a check every time I fell down, I wouldn't know how to get up. So it's really a book and a message around essentially redefining certain concepts around what privilege really is. And, you know, that it's all about figuring it out yourself as opposed to somebody doing it for you, essentially.
Yet, of course, when you talk about the systemic issues, people who don't grow up in the safe neighborhood or people
right.
who don't grow up with that sense of safety and community and are exploited would struggle with that.
Absolutely. And that's actually, I wrote a blog about that because I sat down with some girls who were sold into sex trafficking early on. And I said, how do you say life is what you make it to somebody like that? And you don't. You know, you listen and you learn and you try and figure out how to shift systemically what's going on in whatever way one can. You know, my wife and I are fortunate that we might be able to do things. Certainly others can't, but you never know where it could come from. But there are way too many people that can't say, you know, life is what I make it. There's no question about that. And so I am definitely addressing mostly people with money, you know, kids, regardless, at the university level. I do a lot of shows there. And the whole idea is do what you can with what you've got to make this world more equitable for all, no question.
So where are you on your conversation and music tour now?
Well, I have been doing it a little bit before the book came out. It came out in 2010, and then it's been pretty much a full-time job since then. I mean, I just lied. It's not a full-time job because the foundation is also a full-time job. And so, you know, I'm doing both, and they're sort of interrelated in kind of a curious way, but or they have continued to find common ground in a lot of ways. But I have gone to China now probably 9 times in the last couple of years. The book is a runaway hit in China, and which is probably a topic for another show. But I am very busy out on the road, again, mostly either colleges, community foundations, kind of family wealth management organizations, you know, that sort of thing. So it's an interesting mix of demographic, I guess, out there with the show. And the fun thing about the show, it's called A Concert in Conversation, and I actually take questions through the whole show. Anybody can ask me anything at any time, and that's probably the most fun part for me.
So when are you coming to Los Angeles?
Well, I would love to. For some reason, I'm coming down to Laguna, actually, except I think it's a private show, the end of September. So I'm coming close to Los Angeles. But here's the funny part, is people always say, well, gee, can you come here? And we say, yes, and this is what it costs to do it. And they say, well, oh, we thought it was just going to be you coming. And it's like, well, actually, it's, you know, this is part of how I make a living. You know, I don't take a salary from the foundation. And in fact, I've been a musician all my life and written music for commercials and film and all this stuff. And this is now my livelihood. And so we just have to have somebody bring me. I'm ready to come to LA. I would love to.
We appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. I've been, you know, not responding to everything because, you know, again, people kind of want to draw you in and down into the polarizing debate around good and bad or this or that, and I'm trying to keep the conversation up a notch, you know, to just say, this is what I see, others seem to be seeing it too, and how do we do something about it?
I think that's the kind of questions that need to be asked and need to be broadcast in the public sphere, as they call it. Unfortunately, yeah. Not enough do it.
Yeah, no, somebody kind of criticized me on this idea of writing new code, and what do you mean by new code? And I said, well, Thomas Jefferson wrote new code. You know, I mean, this is not, it's probably something that needs to be done occasionally, and it might be time.
Well, language has a profound effect on reality.
It sure does. It is the skin of culture, as someone once said, and I do think that language and the way we use it has a almost insidious way of kind of taking us towards something that maybe we didn't actually mean. And language is critical to how we move forward. And again, that's why I'm trying to redefine some of the words we use.
And because you're a songwriter and a poet, I think that you're able to do this in a way that maybe a straight business person doesn't.
Well, that's what I'm hoping, is that because I have this different vantage point, you know, partly, of course, because of who my dad is, but also equally so, if not more so, because of what I've been doing all my life, I'm not steeped in it quite like somebody else is. You know, I love to say that, you know, once you start consuming culture, culture starts to consume you. And so if the further you can stay a little bit outside of it to observe it, I think the better in terms of trying to get across some of these ideas that need to be spoken about.
Well, I hope we can continue the conversation at a later date.
Thank you.
Thanks
for having me on the show.
No, it's our pleasure. Thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Bye. When we come back, long-term effects of bullying on individuals, groups, and societies. Stay tuned.
Break the chain in two with what you say. You know how your life was stolen. Who would know it could fall so far? Name the place, the silence.
You are listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. Bullies and victims of bullies are much more likely to develop psychological disorders such as agoraphobia, panic disorder, suicidal thoughts, and aggressive behavior as adults, according to a recent study. In both adult and adolescent settings, bullying cultures can emerge when bystanders and others disengage and allow the behavior to continue, ultimately creating abusive organizations. What is the long-term effect on individuals and, by extension, on societies resulting from bullying behaviors? Three experts join us. Catherine Bradshaw is a professor in the Department of Mental Health at the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health and School of Education. She is the deputy director of the Center for the Prevention of Youth Violence and the co-director of the Center for Prevention and Early Intervention. Her studies include bullies, gangs, drugs, and school, understanding the overlap and the role of ethnicity and urbanicity, risk factors for bullying among children with autism and spectrum disorder, and teachers and education support professionals' perspectives on bullying and prevention. Yana Yuvonen is a professor of developmental psychology at UCLA. She is the author of Peer Harassment in School, The Plight of the Vulnerable and Victimized, and The Rejected and the Bullied, Lessons About Social Misfits from Developmental Psychology. Joyce Heems is chair and professor in the Department of Management and Industrial Relations at West Virginia University. Her publications include A Bully as an Archetypal Destructive Leader and Bullying from the Playground to the Boardroom. Welcome to the three of you. Thank you so much for being with us. What I'd like to start with is long-term effects that bullying has on individuals who might have been either bullied when they were younger or even maybe older, and maybe even the bullies themselves. Catherine Bradshaw, let's start with you. You've said it has a profound effect on mental health all the way into adulthood. What are the effects on individuals and maybe by extension societies?
Well, the research on bullying is relatively recent when it comes to long-term effects. There has been a lot of cross-sectional research documenting immediate impacts and kind of correlates, as we would often think of them, of bullying, and trying to understand what longer-term impacts there are has really only been a more recent development as our longitudinal data systems have become more available to track long-term impacts. But we have seen a range of mental health impacts, including internalizing problems, externalizing problems like aggression, even substance use problems. When you think about the school environment, there are also concerns as it relates to academic performance, school attendance, and academic engagement more broadly.
You have also written a bit about using these longitudinal studies, how youth who have either been bullied or bullies themselves become perhaps later in life more aggressive, delinquent, and maybe even members of gangs. What have you found?
Yes, we're actually seeing a lot of overlap in some cases of the youth that are involved in bullying as both a victim and a perpetrator. Youth that are aggressive and involved in bullying as a victim as well as a perpetrator often struggle with issues around emotion regulation, challenges calming down when they're upset, really trying to understand how they can interact in a way to resolve conflict in a peaceful way.
Yana Yuvonen, let's bring you in. What are the findings that you have seen?
Well, one of the interesting issues to me as we're learning about these long-term effects is the question of why. Why do kids engage in bullying and why is it so incredibly detrimental? One way to think about these issues of why is that bullying may at times serve a function. So rather than thinking about there are mean kids and then there are their poor targets, maybe in part bullying reflects circumstances or situations. There's some evidence suggesting that bullying peaks, especially during transitional periods of time when, for example, kids are transitioning from elementary schools to middle schools. And what we are curious about is how much this sort of bullying that may be in part temporary rather than stable is a reflection of the need to create a status hierarchy that may serve a purpose during a time of transition where kids are not necessarily aligned with their friends yet, when they need to sort of create a structure of their own. So bullying may serve a function during certain times, and when it serves this function, it may be particularly difficult to intervene with because these bullies, as they strive to be dominant individuals in the status hierarchy, they get rewarded by the peers. That is, nobody challenges them. Nobody dares to challenge them because they are so powerful.
Joyce Heems, you've looked at it from organizational perspectives, but I thought maybe what we should do is look first at the psychology. You've talked about the natural target that victims tend to be. What is that natural target?
Well, there is some evidence to say that if someone tends to be shy, reserved, withdrawn in day-to-day, that they may be more of a natural target for bullying. And we have looked at this. In fact, we had an article that said from the playground to the boardroom, in that we were seeing that some degree of evidence that those who were bullies as a child would take that aggressive behavior into the workplace, and that as things are changing, as organizations are changing, increased in change. I know Ivana just said that, you know, there's more changes are coming at people, and especially at the adult level, that they don't know how to handle that. They don't know how to handle that aggression, and maybe they have some resistance to authority. And as things are changing in environments in which they are not comfortable in, they act out in such a way. And they look for those that will not speak up to them, will not stand up. One of the studies that we're looking at now is what we call the worker-to-worker transaction. So not just the abusive supervisor or that power differential between the employee and the supervisor, but if I see someone bullying you and we're all colleagues, why or when would I want to step in? And what we're seeing is people say, I'm not even going to step in as an observer of that because I'm afraid that bully will turn on me. And the victim doesn't want to report the bully because afraid the bully will get even more aggressive. So our culture is not set up in such a way. Companies are just now coming on board. As Catherine said, we don't have longitudinal studies yet that really shares what the long-term effects are going to be. But companies are finally getting on board to say, we're going to have a zero tolerance, and we want a respectful, healthy environment, is how they're phrasing this, and really trying to stay away from the terminology of bullying.
We've got a lot of mental disorders in this particular society in the U.S. Catherine Bradshaw, is there a relationship here?
We have documented through both short-term as well as long-term research that one's involvement in bullying is a risk factor for subsequent and concurrent behavioral and mental health concerns. And it's most pronounced among the youth that are involved as both a target as well as a perpetrator. While it is difficult, however, to tease out the cause versus the consequence, because often youth who are targeted might have internalizing problems, as the previous speaker referenced, or have other problems getting along well with others and thus are marginalized either in the workplace or in the school environment. So this is really a complex phenomenon and often doesn't have very easy solutions. But if we think from a life course perspective that in childhood kids that are exposed to violence in the home or have challenges in their peer group and adopt an aggressive way of interacting with others or are reinforced, because sometimes that works, and that they might reach a higher dominance within their peer network, we can understand, and Jana commented on this, that sometimes that becomes adaptive for some kids. They can get rewarded. And we can very easily see similar extrapolations into the workplace as adults. Individuals that kind of bully others often are hoarding a lot of the resources and the power and the dominance within the work environment. And so that's why it's so important for us to keep in mind that these bullying activities, while we might be a little more comfortable calling them bullying among school-aged youth, and much of the research has taken that approach, there has been increasing interest in what does this really look like in the workplace, and what does this look like in college students or within adult populations. And we really have not seen very much research focused specifically at these issues in adulthood, and which youth continue on and which forms of aggression. For example, people often stereotypically think about bullying as just being physical, when we know the vast majority of bullying acts are more relational in nature and social in nature. And it's my hypothesis that those are really the ones that continue across the life course, and that they can get played out in terms of workplace drama or emails and text messages that are carried on in the workplace for adults. So I think it's really important for us to keep in mind a life course perspective, that these behaviors don't just go away.
Absolutely. If I may pitch in, this is Jana. So I think that it's fascinating the way Joyce talks about the workplace bullying, because really, in the end, it's not only about individuals, those who try to dominate and those who are the easy or safe targets, but it's also about the atmosphere, about the climate. Mm-hmm. Catherine has done work, and we've done some work on how bullying affects the entire climate of a school. So obviously, when we're talking about bullying, one of its most detrimental effects, besides it having long-term consequences for both bullies and victims, is that it really affects the well-being of everyone in that setting. And we have some evidence based on just these kind of daily reports that we do with students in school that even just witnessing somebody else getting bullied elevates their levels of anxiety during that day. So we're talking about pervasive effects on large number of individuals in the setting where bullying takes place.
Let's then go to this idea of a bullying culture. All of you have touched on this a little bit. And Jana, I think in one of your pieces you talked about how popular and dominant bullies control the peer norms. Joyce Heems, I think that this is something that you've also written about in the more organizational and workplace settings. I'm a political scientist, so I, of course, wonder about how this gets carried on into the political settings like Congress, where we see some of this going on now. But when you have bullies as popular cultural leaders and political leaders, what happens to the societies? Joyce, you should start us on that.
Sure, absolutely. First, let me say that I would like to clarify, and we talked about this briefly, and I believe Catherine alluded to this, there is a distinction between what we would determine is workplace bullying and harassment or some other forms of aggressive behavior. And workplace bullying typically is more psychological than it is physical. It is more covert than it is overt. And it's the motivation behind it is not a prejudice or a bias typically. In fact, we found that bullying doesn't have a lot of biases. It's more about something you have that I want. So there's a greed or a jealousy or something along those lines. So I think that's a nice distinction to make in terms of what we're really talking about. But in one of the pieces that we did, more to your point, Maria, is that we talked about the social-emotional contagion theory and how that in the workplace people will often, if you will, catch the emotions and behaviors of other people. So if, for instance, I'm in an environment and cursing is allowed, and it goes on and on and on, I get immune to it after a while. And I may say things that historically I might not have said otherwise. So our environments are very key to this. So if bullying is allowed or is not corrected, is not countered in some way, those around will say, hey, you know, Catherine got away with that, so I bet I can. And they'll take on those types of behaviors. And I think that that cultural issue is really prevalent in this conversation, because organizations have got to take on more directive action in controlling this and putting in the zero tolerance type of policies.
And if they're coming from the leadership itself, then that becomes a complicating factor, I would think.
Ben Tepper and a few of his colleagues, Ben's down at Georgia State, has done a lot about the abusive supervisor and how to control those, and putting in mechanisms back in the 80s and 90s when we were talking about sexual harassment and training and raising that awareness, putting in mechanisms so people could feel comfortable in reporting. And they haven't done that yet, I think, society-wide or organizational across industries for people to report bullying. So it's not just my peer that's bullying me, but it's my boss. How can I go around that? And we've got to put in mechanisms very much like we did to counter the sexual harassment that we saw so prevalent back in the 80s and 90s.
Just a reminder that you are listening to the Scholar Circle, and we're talking about the effects of bullying behavior on individuals, groups, organizations, and societies. Catherine Bradshaw.
Yeah, I think your use of the term zero tolerance is one thing that's gotten a lot of attention and some concern in the literature, and most of that has started off looking in juvenile justice settings and adult criminal offenses, and then has been somewhat extrapolated into the school setting and saying, well, we're going to take a zero tolerance type of approach around school bullying. And what that typically means is anybody that's bullying gets an automatic suspension and sent out. And we've seen other examples of this, of really harsh types of punitive responses to bullying. And frankly, we've learned that that kind of zero tolerance in a more formal policy type of way is one that we don't see a lot of evidence actually working. But I think Joyce is kind of alluding to a more colloquial term of, we're not going to accept this, this isn't tolerable, not that somebody's immediately going to get fired or punished as a result of that. So I think we need to have these environments where people don't feel a threat of turning in someone else, or and understanding the difference between reporting and tattling, as I often hear with kids, is I don't want to be a snitch, I don't want to be the one that kind of outed that person. And so I think as we try to take some of these concepts in the K to grade 12 type of setting and think, well, what would they really look like in the workplace, and are there certain policies and procedures that we would use in one context versus the other? So just want to put that kind of caveat around the zero tolerance type of approach, and what does that really mean from a policy standpoint in the school setting relative to a workplace.
Jana Juvonen.
I think it's interesting to think about the social contagion perspective that Joyce brought up, that indeed we know also in classrooms and in school settings, once there is a kid who gets by and becomes even more popular by bullying other kids, that encourages other kids to engage in bullying as well. But in addition to that, you know, going back to the sort of how bullying affects the entire climate of a setting or a collective, is that often bullying is perceived, although it may be anxiety provoking, people fear and are concerned about becoming the next targets. At the same time, what they actually do behaviorally looks like they enjoy it. They enjoy watching it. That is, bullying often in school settings can be entertaining or amusing. So when the bystanders react that way, even when deep inside they say, oh my gosh, this is not really okay, or I sure hope I'm not going to be the next target, when they laugh, when they smile, they are encouraging bullying. So we get into these kind of vicious cycles, and this is precisely what's so very difficult to try to stop, is that in spite of the sense of unsafety, anxiety, etc., the way we behaviorally convey our attitudes about bullying, they seem to be very encouraging of the bully and bullying behavior. So that's yet another way in which bullying becomes socially contagious.
Social psychologists have frequently talked about why bystanders behave in particular ways, role-playing or the mob kinds of behaviors or groupthink. If, in fact, people naturally shy away from being the one to call it out, is there some way of approaching this to stop the mob? How does this interplay with this issue of bystanders?
This is Joyce. And one of the things that we talked about and are looking at right now is their ability to intervene. And our research is showing that they don't feel comfortable. They don't. Their self-efficacy of their success in that is very low. So they're saying, you know, I don't know how, I don't know whether I'd be effective. Would I make it worse for that person? Would I make it worse for me? You know, I was struck a couple years ago, my son-in-law is an orthopedic surgeon, and he was talking about this lady that had a major accident, and I made the comment, I said, oh my goodness, she'll never walk again. He said, no. He said, I can do this, I can fix that, I can mend this, and 6 months I'll have her up and walking. And I thought, you know, his ability, his knowledge of how to fix that situation, his efficacy was out the roof, his confidence level in that particular task. We don't have that when we're talking about the emotional, psychological impact, and especially of something so severe as what we're terming here as bullying. It takes someone who really has, even with social identity, we looked at if I think a fellow female is being bullied, would I tend to step in quicker? And yes, the research is showing that we would if we identify with that person in some way, because we don't want them to be bullied. So I would step in quicker if it was a female than if it was a man. If it's a child, absolutely. Everyone tends to you know, want to run to the rescue of a child. But their thought process is, if I step in, can I make it better? Will I make it worse for them and for me? So it's hard for them to know how. We did some experimental studies and looked at training, and it was very little increase in their willingness to step in, even though they had some degree of training in how to do that. Again, that takes a lot, and this takes a psychologist or someone who really would feel comfortable doing that.
Is there a pathology that develops? For example, do bullies become authoritarian personalities? Do they become antisocial? Given the degree of people behind bars now, is there a relationship that you think has developed from this? Catherine, I think this is something that you started to talk about.
At a basic level, we know that an early onset of aggressive and pretty serious disruptive behavior problems can be a risk factor for what is often referred to as a life course persistent pattern of aggressive behavior. There have been researchers that have been looking at this both within the U.S. and internationally to try to understand some of those early precursors of aggressive behavior across the life course. And some of those include executive functioning problems, so kids' brains just operate a little bit differently than others, have problems with impulse control, emotion regulation. And so while those studies have been focused more generally on the issue of aggressive behavior, trying to understand some of these long-term outcomes, bullying could be one of those behaviors, but it's very difficult to look at a broader set of aggressive behaviors and say, well, does this generalize to every kid that bullies or to every kid that's aggressive? Because we know some kids, you know, have a transition problem and thus they're vulnerable to experiencing difficulties and challenges, but through intervention they're able to get back on the right track or just kind of grow out of it, or in a peer context it's more supportive for one type of behavior over the other. So I think there is potential for aggressive behavior that has an early onset and is not intervened with effectively to lead to a more serious pattern of aggressive and problem behavior, and could lead to criminal activity as well as more serious psychopathology in adulthood. We see that tends to be highest among youth that are involved in bullying as both a target and as a perpetrator. And for example, one of our recent studies had shown that youth that were involved in bullying on both ends were much more likely to carry weapons and more likely to enter gangs. And so even taking gang activity as an example, I actually see some parallels between bullying and gang activity. For example, the power and status associated with aggression and aggressive behavior, dominance over others. Quite often there's a fear that you're going to be targeted by the gang if you don't become a member of the gang, and it's a very aggressive network and complex network around power that's drawing them together. So I see some similarities there on some basic levels. However, we have to be very, very cautious not to assume that every kid that engages in aggressive or bullying behavior is going to get on this life course persistent pathway, because there are some youth that engage in these behaviors and kind of trying them on, and they don't work out very well for them. They don't meet their need, be they social or instrumental, and perhaps also through effective intervention, we're able to get them off of that path. So frankly, the fact that we have, you know, let's say 18 to 20% of youth have been the victim of bullying, we don't have those extremely high rates of adult psychopathology. But if they're not addressed, it can cause problems in their adult relationships, their relationships with their significant others, or even be passed on to their children. So we have to be cautious. In fact, I gave a talk on bullying at a psychiatric hospital in upstate New York, and afterwards one of the physicians came up to me and said, I feel like you're pathologizing the issue of bullying. We have to remember that there are a lot of kids that find themselves in a situation either because other peers are doing it through this peer contagion process that was discussed, that they engage in that behavior. And if it's addressed early on and effectively, I think it can really pull them off of that more negative trajectory.
Pertaining to globalization, and Joyce Heems, this is something you wrote about, how globalization might be enhancing, for lack of a better word, a bullying culture. Can you describe what you mean by this?
Well, we're talking about the rapid rate of change and the complexity of the organizations as they're going global, and as you're putting more diverse people together and them trying to understand and their comfort level with that. I'd also like to take that and talk a little bit about what Catherine was talking about and recognize that both the bully and victims, as we see them, and just anyone in general, has different coping mechanisms and different abilities to cope. So a young person who was exposed to bullying, maybe even tried it on, realized it didn't fit, and their coping mechanisms are strong enough that they break the bonds from that. By the same token, you may have a victim that has very low self-esteem, and their ability, they turn something that is really not bullying, and in their mind it becomes bullying because they don't have sufficient coping mechanisms in place. And that may have come from the fact they had been exposed to it as a child or some others, so they just don't know how to respond to it. So when we talk about globalization, we're talking about different cultures, different ways of responding, different ways of coping, and having to, as managers, having to interpret those different societal issues that people are coming from. So it just creates a whole level of complexity by adding this globalization to the workplace.
Jana Juvonen?
Well, let me very quickly on the issue of globalization. You know, that's a little harder to put it in the sort of world of school. But one issue, since Joyce mentioned, has to do with diversity that we're very intrigued about. We've been in Los Angeles studying the role of ethnic diversity. On one hand, you may think that when there's a lot of ethnic diversity in a school, you're going to get even more bullying that may be in part motivated by some sort of bias or self-preservation. But at the same time, what we are actually finding is that diversity can be protective. That is, when we find these really diverse, ethnically diverse schools where there's no one dominant ethnic group, but multiple groups about equal in size or relatively so, we get students reporting that they feel safer and they feel less bullied. And I think that's one of the ways in which we have to start doing this research is to find out more about these protective factors. In terms of social risk factors, I mean, other protective factors that decrease the risk factors for bullying is a presence of a friend. So we have to learn a little bit more about what makes a difference, what enables the bully or a victim cope better. And we know that when they feel socially supported, when their social dominance needs or their sense of vulnerability are met with somebody in the setting, everybody's better off.
That's a perfect place to end. Thank you to the three of you, Catherine Bradshaw, Jana Juvonen, and Joyce Heems. Catherine Bradshaw is a professor in the Department of Mental Health at the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health and School of Education. She is the deputy director of the Center for the Prevention of Youth Violence and the co-director of the Center for Prevention and Early Intervention. Her studies include Bullies, Gangs, Drugs, and School, Understanding the Overlap and the Role of Ethnicity and Urbanicity, Risk Factors for Bullying Among Children with Autism and Spectrum Disorder, and Teachers and Education Support Professionals' Perspectives on Bullying and Prevention. Jana Juvonen is a professor of developmental psychology at UCLA. She is the author of Peer Harassment in School, The Plight of the Vulnerable and Victimized, and The Rejected and the Bullied, Lessons About Social Misfits from Developmental Psychology. Joyce Heems is chair and professor in the Department of Management and Industrial Relations at West Virginia University. Her publications include A Bully as an Archetypal Destructive Leader and Bullying from the Playground to the Boardroom. That's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to the Scholar Circle team who makes this show possible, Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Leonardo Alanis, and Joe Pinto. Most of all, thank you for listening. And if you missed a part of the show, you can go back either to the kpfk.org audio archives, or you can go to scholarcircle.org. You can hear us on iTunes and on Stitcher, and you can follow me at @Armudian.